once, not long ago, New Zealanders were closer to self-sufficiency as a community. We were leaders in cooperative business ventures, and now we need to be more savvy and astute to political processes so that we do not become totally dependent on the global financial apparatus. Our sovereignty as a nation need not be dictated from banking corporations and unknown financiers somewhere overseas. So how can we again become more self-sufficient and sustainable as a country, and become more conscious as citizens and a moral force for a new planetary model? In the studio this morning, I have Elaine West, an educator who has been involved in local government politics here in Auckland, where she has covered a very diverse number of issues that will affect all Aucklanders and New Zealanders as we go into our collective future. Chairing many local groups of concerned citizens around tolls on motorways, the selling off of council pensioner flats, keeping West Haven Marina in council hands, opposing house rate hikes, the New Zealand Rugby Stadium down on the wharves, soil contamination from removal from the Auckland City Council limb report, continuing the Overlander train, and genuine progress indicators. And finally, as an assistant to the Auditor General, to write a report regarding government and local authorities and processes and consultation. So kia ora, Elaine.
Kia ora, Tim. Lovely to be here.
Kia ora, yes. It's a lovely greeting to be able to welcome the day. Elaine, how did you find yourself involved in so many issues?
Well, Tim, maybe it's in the blood. In 1893, my great-great-great-grandmother was one of the first women in the world to vote, and possibly her daughter. So that's a wonderful heritage to have. And my great-grandfather took part in the cooperative dairy factory in Hereford Road. So these are things that New Zealanders really are proud of, I believe. And I'm proud to have that heritage, as I said. How did I start in local government affairs? I had entered submissions to Auckland City Council previous to 2001, the elections of 2001. One of the submissions that came to fruition was free buses in the CBD. At the time, the council laughed and thought it was a joke and not possible. Now it's one of their great success stories, and I've met people coming from other districts just to ride on the free buses that circle the town. When John Banks came into view, it was on my TV, and Wake Up Auckland and citizens were rioting against the pensioner housing and the sell-off of community housing. It was quite, I believe, a vicious attack on elderly people. And when I saw Mr. Banks, as Mayor of Auckland City Council, deride a pensioner on TV, I just thought to myself, he doesn't do that on my territory. And so from there, I put in a submission to council, and I was amazed that there was media interest and people around. I didn't expect it. I just went down. I'm an ordinary citizen doing what I believe the job of most New Zealanders would do. And after a year, we were satisfied with the fact that the community housing stayed in public hands, albeit with the government. We didn't want that to go into private hands. Along the way, I met many pensioners, and they were so distressed, and I thought, is this what we have come to? So that really started me off in all sorts of directions.
Yes, because you even led a street march up Queen Street on a tax revolt.
Yes, that was further on. I was chair of a new lobby group called the Auckland City Residents and Ratepayers. And we put in submissions on the Victoria Park motorway tunnel because we had a heritage park there that needed saving. And transit, we got public meetings going, and transit agreed if funding was found. I then realised when I presented to Auckland City Council on that topic that the council had already approved tolls, and I don't believe anyone in 2003, early 2003, knew about it. I was certainly surprised. leading them to also we visited the ports of Auckland to look at fumigation practice and to retain West Haven, again a public asset in public hands. The rates revolt came about when the Auckland Regional Council, without warning, raised residential rates to up to about 800 plus percent, and that was, most rates were raised about 300%, and they fragmented the region to break down public resistance. I could see what they were doing, probably along with a lot of other people. And as it started in Rodney, then moved to North Shore, I called together representatives of ratepayer associations and groups, and they met at my house, and we organised a meeting in Grey Lynn in the church hall. From there, we established a petition that was region-wide. 100,000-plus people took part in the rates revolt. So it was enormous for today's actions, political actions. We also, in another meeting in Grey Lynn, with a steering group made up of different citizen groups, decided that we'd have a march down Queen Street, which we did. And the march was strange in the sense that a lot of elderly people represented the marches, and the families who often came represented the elderly people. So although not as great as the region-wide revolt, it still showed that people on the subject of rates, which isn't seen as very exciting to a lot of young people especially, that the subject of rates was to be kept in the forefront. Because what was happening is people were being told by politicians, especially elderly people, and perhaps families, that they could sell up if they couldn't pay their rates. And the idea that you own a home and can't pay the rates is abominable.
Yes, I know. I've come across many elderly people who are struggling. Unfortunately, there is that $500 rates rebate that they can get now if they qualify.
Yes, well, that's thanks to the rates revolt too. Because leading on from there, we held cottage evenings in people's homes, and they went down and lobbied the MPs. At that second rates revolt meeting in Grey Lynn, the steering group had collated 11 resolutions. One of those resolutions was that the benchmark should be raised to $20,000, and it should be raised also according to inflation. Well, the government has raised the benchmark to $20,000 and $500 rebate. There are extras with some councils, but they haven't raised it to the Consumer Price Index, which is lacking.
Yes, I'd like to be able to talk to you about that a little later on in the program. And so you've always had this ability to be involved in and assist, be a sort of a still person in the midst of a storm in many cases. You've chaired many different groups to bring about change. Now, I know that you had the problem with the soil that was contaminated from market gardens or orchards, and you also had been involved with the overlander, kept making sure that the overlander stayed on as a train service from Auckland to Wellington and back. And can you show any more light on this, on these sorts of subjects? Why are these things happening?
The soil contamination came about because the councils across Auckland believed that some of the residential houses and new development properties were built on contaminated soil, but they hadn't proven it. So they seemed, many of the councils seemed to just think they could add it to the LIM report. Basically, if that was on the LIM report, then the sale price, if your house was put up for sale, would drop because it could possibly be contaminated, but they hadn't proven it, so it's like really pigs can fly attitude. So I got together with another group from PAMUA, the PAMUA Community Action Group, and the Soil Contamination Action Movement from Avondale area, and together we used to work together on weekends, form submissions, write to MPs, and the government became involved to a greater degree because of the upset in Auckland. And Auckland City Council withdrew, as a result, Auckland City Council withdrew the soil contamination from the LIM report unless it was proven. So that was a victory. We, Waitakere City Council, as far as I know, didn't do that. It kept it on, which I'm not sure what the position is today. As for the overlander, it's an affront, I find, that under privatisation of the Rogernomic era, that the symbol of train travel was about to be wiped from this country. It was like putting a nail in the coffin. And like many New Zealanders across the country, I was upset and got involved in that too. And I wrote to district councils such as the Ruapehu District Council and others, and the people of Manawatu also became involved in the particular correspondence that I had. So together, I think it was New Zealanders who saved that train. It wasn't me, it wasn't one person, it was all of us.
Because New Zealand Rail is actually going to become very important in the coming future, where we need to be able to use this mechanism or this method of transportation from city to city because of the so-called fuel challenges that are coming up.
I brought that up as one of the indicators in the case that was made, that we have already signed the Kyoto Agreement and therefore we are obliged to use rail travel.
Yes, in my introduction I mentioned how when the fourth Labor government came in, Rogernomics came to signify the letting go of all our prime assets, particularly, of course, state insurance, government life, and telecom, and the railways, etc. So the privatisation that came in, it sort of left a lot of New Zealanders distraught. How have you, what is your take on this?
The free market or privatisation or the globalisation theory says that free enterprise is the uppermost and fundamental way of economic good. History tells us now, based on evidence, that the politicians got it wrong. Not only did the politicians get it wrong, but the international global market got it wrong. There is enough evidence by experts around that will prove that. I would like to see the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Helen Clark, seeing the Labour government introduced it in 1984 under Rogernomics, and John Key of the National Opposition, whose National Party led the way of privatisation. Well, really, they did sell things off, public assets off. I'd like to see them say they got it wrong, because there is evidence to say that. Of course, I don't expect they will, but they did. And they wronged New Zealanders and all our heritage that Tim introduced at the beginning. That was devalued. New Zealanders were disregarded. And the public voice was lost. And not only was the public voice lost, but we lost what was built up many years before for the future generations. And now the government has the call to continue. And in my view, the National Party will continue at breakneck speed. So there needs to be a true left party, because we know we have a true right party. Centre left and centre right is practically the same. So we're worse off. What happened was that the top 10% of the nation in 2001 owned 53% of the national assets. The top 10% of the nation got rises of 10% in salaries. The rest, the middle income earners, wages dropped, and the lowest percentile, the lowest quarter percentile, went backwards to the degree where it was very hard to recover. Instead of the poverty line being 22%, it dropped to 19%. A survey of the Otago University in 2006 shows the correlation between income, mortality rates, and illness. The lower the income, the more sick our society. So for people to go and talk about an underclass is actually misleading, misrepresenting, and it's devaluing New Zealand society again for the mistakes that these leaders have made and their political parties. Globalisation involves the free movement of people, goods, services and capital across the world. That means that the corporations, the multinational corporations and the bigger ones called the transnational corporations, have access to markets that are unfettered by regulation. So the investors in the country's infrastructure are usually not interested in poorer countries or poorer economies. They usually go for the middle-income economies or the wealthier economies. There is research to show now that it's not doing these economies much good, although that's not what we're told by the media. The problem with the multinationals also is not only foreign direct investment, which goes into countries and then moves the capital moves out again, but it's also that with merging corporations, the business side is falling into fewer and fewer hands. So we are getting huge corporations almost running the world and feeling that they can run governments. And this is a problem for New Zealand. And it's an escalating problem.
Yes, we've got this as a big one now of a codex, a Trans-Tasman health issue regarding vitamins and minerals. This is a big one because Australia's heavying New Zealand and particularly heavying the Labor Party. And, of course, the Labor Party is trying to ram this through. And it's imperative that New Zealanders rise to the occasion on this one and say to the Labor government, you can't allow the Australians to elbow us on this particular issue.
I believe there's more to it than that too, which I can come back to later with the cards and microchips. With globalisation, though, where have we come out on this? Where have we come with overseas banks now lending most of the money in New Zealand? We've just got the Kiwi Bank and the Taranaki Savings Bank for New Zealanders. So what do we owe as a country? Well, we have student debt of $9 billion. We have mortgage lending that now stands at $127 billion. And we have a deficit of $14.5 billion. In total, it adds up to $151 billion that we owe as New Zealanders. Now you need to remember that amount of money, because with tolls on roads, with user charges, the ordinary person who owes $151 billion as a collective society is going to be paying more. And who benefits? The corporations who lend the money.
Yes, I think, particularly with GE, say GE Finance, I don't want to give them a hard time, but they were able to get money in America after 9/11 at 1% interest. And they come down to New Zealand and they spin it out and, I don't know, 15, 16, 17, 18%.
Well, I go with Brian Gould, who's written a book on the democracy sham, and he believes that the main problem in globalisation, how it comes about, is through breaking down regional boundaries, and it's also through the monetary policies. Now, the monetary policies has a reserve bank or a central bank, and that bank determines how, or they're obliged by the New Zealand government, through a contract with the New Zealand government, to keep inflation down within the band of 1% to 3%. So by increasing interest, He is, this is the Reserve Bank, Dr. Bollard, is actually artificially revaluing the New Zealand dollar, so it's not at its real rate. So therefore we have what's called hot money. People from overseas go for a quick killing, speculation, wow, lots of money in New Zealand, but they always have a pull-out plan. So that means, according to Brian Gould's theory, we're on a roller coaster ride, up and down. The best way to get over that is to regulate and have fiscal policy also. But we can talk about that later too, Tim.
Yes, because Brian Gould, he was the deputy in the British Labour Party back in about 1990, and of course now he's the Chancellor at Waikato University, and I feel that he's very out there, particularly with his statement. He's really made a stand for, not in common sense, but for honesty as well.
Well, when I saw that the interest rates went up this recently, I just thought, goodness me, it's exactly what we don't need. We don't need this interest rate hike that artificially raises our value, because it affects our productivity and the exporters can't make money on our dollar. And this is where often you get unemployment coming in, because they can't keep staff. At the moment they're holding on to them because it's harder to get skilled people. But it actually has repercussions that ripple right through the economy. So the government needs to regulate and find the real currency value. And that way, Malaysia did it, and they weathered the Asian storm, the Asian crisis.
And could you tell the listeners a little bit about Ron Coleman and the economic indicators?
Okay, Ron Coleman goes beyond the economic indicators. He looks at indicators for quality of life, standard of living, taken up by the Canadian government, and the Canadian, I think even the corporations have got quite excited, and he often comes over here to an organiser of a new New Zealand Day brewer who runs workshops with people like me and others who set up the global progress indicators. That is, everything doesn't have to be pinned to the GDP, the gross domestic
product.
That's
it.
Thank you, Tom. It was scary. Anyway, so we're looking at social indicators. Now, we can see through Rogernomics that socially we were deprived and we haven't really recovered. We're still on the same track. So we need indicators to show that, hello, it's gone down and further down. Shouldn't we be rising here? Now, this happens with the toll roads too. Economically, the government will show you or tell you how wonderful it is. Does not show you anything about the terrible social impact toll roads on New Zealand, in New Zealand would have. So it ignores it. Another one is the environmental indicator that pollution caused through cars really destroys the environment. Now, that could be an indicator.
Yes, because 400 people a year in New Zealand die through taking in molecules from a car exhaust into their being.
I brought this up in 2003 at the public meeting and said, you know, if you look at a little baby, just think of those little particles getting stuck in its lungs. Now, the government did a ministry report on cars in New Zealand in 2002, and they came up with about 236 at the time. It increased, I think, with the ARC up to 270-something, so we levelled out. So they knew for years that Aucklanders were dying through car pollution, and yet the cars increased and public transport was kept to a minimum.
Yes, well, defies, in many ways, logic. However, of course, we've got to be able to... There are a number of bits of information that you would like to share with us before we can finally get to some solutions.
Okay.
And could you lead with...
All right. I'm going to lead with the Auckland Mayoral Forum and how globalisation tampers with and possibly... either changes or destroys or distorts democracy and the processes of democracy. I didn't know much about this until I was investigating tolls on roads, and in 2003 when I found out the Auckland City Council had approved it, I thought I would do my own research. I wrote to the Auckland Mayor, I called George Wood, North Shore Mayor, City Mayor, and asked if I could speak to the Auckland Mayoral Forum, and he said it depends, and I said, well, you're a public body, why can't I? And he says, well, you have to go through us. Later I found that there was a document on transport that the Mayoral Forum had put together immediately after the 2001 elections, and I wrote to the emailed the Mayor of Rodney District, John Law, to ask if I could have a copy. He said no, because they were not a statutory body, they didn't have to publicly consult. And I wondered what was going on here. Now, I had been mistakenly, I think, given a copy of a Mayoral Forum report in 2003, and I was astounded. They were talking about tolls, debt funding, public-private partnerships, the government not having such a big say in how private investment is spent or gained. And so I then got the document through Auckland City Council under the Official Information Act and found that without Aucklanders knowing, that the mayors had presented to councils a program that was called Unprecedented, where they would lobby government to change legislation for PPPs, public-private partnerships, or privatisation inclusion in road funding. They would also want to see the change in the Resource Management Act to make it faster and to raise loans. Now, the Mayor of Rodney District had not told his constituents, who were in the middle of writing submissions on the Northern Extension Motorway, State Highway 1, called Albert B2, that is from Orewa to Puhoi. And he, from all indications, did not tell his people that he was lobbying government to toll new roads. Instead, he was involved in a petition where loans would be raised. Now, as far as I know, at that time, no mayor came out and said, we are lobbying government. Now, the councils went through and approved their paper, and eventually it ended up with the Regional Land Transport Committee. By this time, as time went, with a little bit of time, the government was in on the scene. Now, when the council put the papers together, the proposal papers, they invited selected business groups. The general public did not know. Eventually, the public were told that the road could not be built, although it was promised to be built as an untolled road. They changed their minds. Now it could not be built unless it was tolled. So the people felt that they had no other choice. The road is going to be tolled. It's 7.5 kilometres long, and it will be seen as New Zealand's flagship tolled road. I'd like to see the toll come off.
Yes, because businesses can always just write off their toll charge. But for Joe Sixpack, here driving around in his car, having to go to work every week, every day every week, he does not have a business to write that money off. So consequently, it's going to cost him another $20 or something to use that piece of a road every week.
That's exactly right. And what happened was that the mayors, and I don't think they really cared for this document that came up because they didn't bring it up themselves, they did research on road pricing and found the socio-economic impact of workers who travelled across the Auckland region, that tolls would have a negative impact on the most vulnerable people in society, that is the low income, the middle income with high overheads, families taking children to school, people, the elderly who may find that, well, it was fixed income, people who are disabled. Now, all this went through despite that, and people in the Rodney District actually complained. They said, we're not going to be able to afford this toll. Maori complained for iwi and whānau, and the general public. I found that the hearing panel were not, from what I found, were not aware of the social economic impact on the population. So I complained to the Auditor General and said, how can a panel decide to toll a road when it didn't know all the facts? For some reason, the social economic impact didn't rub with the Auditor General. The economic one did, because they said, oh, well, they did consult and did it properly. I also complained about the Auckland Mayoral Forum and their behaviour. And I was told that because they were ex officio, these are my words, summarising it, this is not a statutory body, that the Auditor General could do nothing about it and I would have to take them to High Court. So we have a group of Auckland elected representatives, government elected representatives, meeting secretly. The public were not allowed reports at the time or inside meetings. They only invited selected business groups, and they formed legislation that was sweeping, that would have sweeping social changes and economic impact, and New Zealanders didn't know.
So how do people in general stand up to this? How do they bring about a resolution to make sure that this is changed and doesn't happen?
Well, it hasn't changed because the mayors are still doing it with the government. It's public consciousness that needs to be raised. Recently, the mayors Hubbard, Curtis, Law, Wood and Harvey, along with others who weren't such instigators, have been pushing for a Greater Auckland Council. The Greater Auckland Council would have, in their vision, one plan for the Auckland region. A forum beneath them would give them advice which they would not have to take. The forum would also have non-elected representatives on it at times. This issue of non-elected representatives is very, very important, because I believe this is the way we are going, and that elected representatives will become puppets of the non-elected representatives. We can already see this with ARTA, Auckland Regional Transport Authority. I presented as chair of Auckland City Residents and Ratepayers to the select committee and said I was concerned that non-elected representatives were on the board. Not one elected representative was going to find out about their decisions on transport. And yet they were accountable to the ARC, the Auckland Regional Council, and the Auckland Regional Council had responsibility for them, and yet the Auckland Regional Council was not on the board of directors. So logically, it doesn't fit. It can actually be, therefore, a determinant of the future, that if we actually don't put the democratic process right and correct, then our future under a world economy, single economy, would see, I believe, that we are heading for non-elected boards run by corporates who tell elected representatives what to do.
Well, it's pretty horrific, but I can understand what you're saying very clearly, because we know that it's only through participatory democracy that we can actually be taking care of the needs of a community. And it's an imperative. I know that Scoop, the local website here, also have called or stated that action over surveillance needed. That's on the 18th of April. They're talking about a super gold card, microchips and state and private corporate surveillance on New Zealand citizens. And so it's interesting that Scoop wants to run with this. Can you add anything to this?
I was rung a couple of weeks ago by a person who said, have you found out about the amendment on the Social Security Entitlement Cards Amendment Act? And I said, no. She said, I think this is going to affect us all. So another person, an elderly man, who will get the super gold card because he's 86 and he's a leader in his community and has been for a long time, He said he's concerned about this. So I rang another elderly man who's just gentleman, who's just turned 80, also a leader in his community, and he said, I don't like the sound of this either. The more we discussed it, the worse it got. And that's because Clause 4 of the Act, that we thought the pensioners, 555,000 pensioners, were going to get a gold card, and I thought, good on them. You know, fair enough. All the discounts, they should have free bus travel, and they're valued members of society. They deserve it. Well, the government is including a clause for a new regulation-making power, and nobody knows what that means, not even parliamentarians. So we've got a new regulation-making power, and digital room for digital photographs on the card, and a microchip. Now, the government has said they wouldn't do this at the moment, but there is a it says at present, so it's written into law. Taking that further in discussion with these people, we found that with information sharing, all your little bits and pieces are going to be on the microchip. And that means you can be shared among departments and all your birth, death certificates, and make sure you're the right person. They would say, it's to stop fraud. Okay, take it a step further. An email I've got came from Palmerston North told me about something happening in Britain, and that is there is a step now towards human microchipping. That microchipping dogs is just the play area. That is going to be followed up with human microchipping, and the Information Commissioner, Richard Thomas, has warned Britons that human microchipping is within 10 years. It will happen within 10 years. So if we as New Zealanders allow the gold card for 550,000 people to be microchipped, it's really the start for all beneficiaries who number hundreds of thousands, and I believe for a New Zealand identity citizens card. The editor of Vanity Fair, I'm sorry, I've forgotten his name, has warned that circumstances could be like DNA samples. Information on DNA samples has actually travelled the globe, and now people's personal DNA information has been lost. No one knows where it ends up. So if you take the microchip further, it means information about us that's stored will be able to travel to anyone who is a microchip reader, all about us, and I believe it will go into the hands of major corporations and government agencies.
Right, well, how do we mobilise consciousness?
How do we do this? How do we stop? Well, we need to brainstorm together as a nation. We actually need debate. The media is very hard to get through, the mainstream media. It has been seen as an area that I believe needs a charter so that New Zealanders know. We're having lots of New Zealand media people and positions going over to Australia for our major newspapers and possibly our major television programs. So already our information could end up overseas and we haven't a clue where. This could happen with toll roads too if we let tolls go through. Okay, how can we stop this? Well, I've got some ideas, and the first of all I'll use Brian Gould's from his book, is regulate currency, the currency rate. It'll stop the high interest value, which has been, it's a superficial value being put on. So the governor of the Reserve Bank should make a call to government to regulate currency rates to their real value. That way we'll be safer if there's some sort of recession, because it's already at real value. We're not going through this roller coaster high interest rate rise. I believe Malaya did it, and I believe that we should get profits back from overseas corporations. I was told a few years ago 40% of our national gross income goes overseas. I believe it's more. Someone said to me it's probably 75% by now. Goodness knows what it is. That can be found out, no doubt. There should be a levy on it. Malaya did it, and when money is speculative, such as high interest rates coming from Japan, money's coming from Japan, thus it's speculative, they're going to take their money out as soon as the interest rate drops. All that will stop with regulating currency exchange. But we should be able to get a lot of that money back. It's our hard-earned money. And instead of making the poor poorer and the wealthy wealthier, we should actually say this money was earned by New Zealanders. It's hard worked by to pay off a mortgage for a house. Two people in the family now need to go to work to pay that mortgage, and yet the money's going overseas. We need infrastructure. We need trains. We need buses. We need hospitals. We need schools. They must not be privatised. They belong to us. They belong to our children. They're our children's heritage, and we do have to fight for them because the power of the corporations is strong, and the power, the economic power is strong, but the social will of the people is stronger, and together we can make a difference. Another way is genuine progress indicators, that we don't say just GDP, economic circumstances. We say, what are the social circumstances? What are the repercussions socially if we do this? How will it affect families? How will it affect the low income? How will it affect the elderly? Is their quality of life improving? And that's environment too. We have a future now where there's a review going on, a rates inquiry panel. They're looking at debt funding, and so is Auckland City Council and the councils. Auckland City Council is going for $1.5 billion in debt, and already we are $151 billion as a nation. Anyway, we have now the people who are inheriting the authority, the control, the running of the country, it will fall into their hands, have also got on their shoulders climate change, a huge debt. Education is not free when it should be. Quality education should be free. It's our children's right. This is what people did fight for, a better New Zealand for our children. All this will be taken away by multinational and transnational corporations. They will not care about social impact. They will not care about the environment. And it's this not caring that actually is affecting the majority of us. Only the tiny, tiny, tiny percentage are benefiting, whereas it's the majority, 90%, who need to know that their life here is a good life. It's a quality life. They don't have to go into another country to find quality life. We can do it. We can do it as a nation.
So how do we mobilise people to participate in this new democracy that we so, you know, we want in our heart?
Okay. Just before we talk about that, we'll have a look at participatory democracy. I studied democracy to see, what is it? What are we talking about? Is it just Abraham Lincoln saying, for the people, by the people, with the people, and those words, some such words? It went back. Before 600 BC, the Phoenicians were seen as a self-governing country, and it was probably in other countries too. And what happened is the Greeks went over and said, oh, that looks good, self-autonomy, they're looking after themselves, these people. So they took it back, and the Spartans, they were seen as often aggressive warriors, they actually had a constitution and began the democratic procedure. But then they lost it and became warriors again. But it moved to Athens, and it's known as the Western civilization's home of democracy, cradle of democracy. The first part of democracy was participatory. It wasn't representational only. And what they did, it's wonderful, because this is all 500 years BC. What they did was they would draw lots out, women, slaves and children weren't included because we weren't really people then, or worthwhile citizens. It seems not as valued as the probably the landed gentry, but it was still not just aristocratic families. And they pulled their names out of the hat, and whoever's name was up they were the leader of the day. So if a prince came from another country on his boat to talk trade, the person went down and talked trade with them. Now, how about that? What does that make us look like if people, ordinary people, could talk trade with princes from another country? I think that's just amazing. So what can we do? How can we get involved? Because we need to be involved. If we don't get involved, we've lost it. The cottage industries worked well. The cottage meetings. When we got together and we said, okay, let's work. It's easier together with people. And it worked. The people went to the MPs with their own statements. And they said, you're our local MP. This is what we want. We want regulation of currency. We want genuine progress indicators. We want to get the money back from overseas, so put levies on the money. It might be differential differentiated in the fact that if it's fast money, they might have to pay more. And long-term investment, if it's needed, they can perhaps pay a bit less. So work out the ways that it's better for our children. We want schools, hospitals. We want libraries, parks, to be in public ownership for the public good as a public service. This is what you do. You put down what you want. We had those things. You're not asking extraordinarily difficult things. You're actually asking what we had. We want it back. And in fact, you demand it back. You demand that. This is a left government and now. You demand it. And you demand it from the right government, that the Rogernomics of the day has proven to be wrong and has proven to be unjust, socially unjust, economically unjust, environmentally unjust. So you get out there and you meet together, you get on the phone and you say, I'm going to come round, cup of tea on Saturday, and we're going to sit down and we're going to write out this letter to the MP, we're going to write it to our mayor to stop holding secret meetings, to stop tolling our roads behind our backs or wanting to toll them. And you can do it. You can do it. You can all do it.
Very good. Yes, it's so important.
Okay.
That's right, because I know that if you get a group of people to go and see the MP, all of a sudden four or six people come through the door, the MP realises that there's that many votes at stake. If there's one person just coming through the door, they can sort of just flag that possible one vote. But I definitely feel that New Zealanders have to stand up to the plate now, get out and make sure, call them up. And as you say, transparency in local government.
Yes. Yes, I think New Zealanders have proven to be leaders. Every single New Zealander is a leader. You don't wait to be told. You get up there and you do it. If I could, Tim, just read this quote. This was something that was put on a submission. We owe it to future generations to do the right thing. They won't think much of us if we don't. That's our job.
Lovely. Thank you, Elaine. That was Elaine West talking about local government and participatory democracy.